Welcome to the 2018 Four Seas Podcast, where we'll share stories of writing teachers and scholars, we'll talk about their work, and we'll talk about how you can get involved with groups in the Seas organization. We hope you listen and subscribe to the podcast. We'll be releasing and airing episodes today and each day of the convention. My name is Matt Gomez. I'm an assistant professor of writing, rhetoric, and American cultures at Michigan State University.
Today is Thursday, March 14th. This morning, today, the 2018 Four Seas Convention is in full swing. That's not a pun. But Kansas City is an important jazz city. I can't tell you about it now, but you can hear about it on the Four Seas soundtrack. Check out the Four Seas Jazz soundtrack, KC Jazz, at bit.ly/CCCCKCJazz. That's bit.ly/CCCCKCJazz. Hope you made it to the newcomers coffee hour this morning at 7:30. After that, the day will kick off with a general opening session. The opening session begins at 8:30 a.m. in the Convention Center Grand Ballroom. We heard yesterday from Jackie Herman Elliott about her contemplative writing pedagogy workshop. That workshop and others take place today in the Kansas City Exhibit Hall, beginning at 12:15 p.m. Also, the all-attendee event will be in the Kansas City Convention Center in the Grand Ballroom, 2501 A and B. That'll be from 1:45 p.m. to 3 p.m. We heard Program Chair Asao Inouye describe that event in our first episode. And several episodes ago, we heard from Christiane Donahue and her work with the International Researchers Consortium. The Consortium Standing Group Business Meeting is happening today at 4:45 p.m. in the Kansas City Convention Center, room 2505B. The Feminist Caucus Business Meeting is happening at the same time, also in the Kansas City Convention Center, in room 2515B. We'll open today's episode with a discussion I had with the Feminist Caucus. They'll tell us a little about their contributions to the convention this year, which includes a quilting project in an effort to capture the moment of this year's convention. Additionally, I talked to the caucus about their work and research around labor issues in writing programs.
I'm Cassie Phillips. I work for the University of Wisconsin Colleges, which is being dissolved on July 1st, but absorbed into different 4 years in Wisconsin. So I don't know what I'm, as of July, I don't know where I'm from. That's not true. Milwaukee. It'll be Milwaukee. So
I'm Kate Pantelides. I am an assistant professor at Middle Tennessee State University. And I am the co-director of General Education English here and the co-chair of the Feminist Caucus.
I'm Melissa Nicholas. I'm at University of California, Merced, where I direct the writing program. I'm associate dean for undergraduate education, and I'm a member of the Feminist Caucus.
And what does the Feminist Caucus have going on at the convention this year?
The Feminist Caucus is very eager to have more members, and we would love people to join our listserv, our Facebook, and to come to our SIG. We are, during our SIG, and actually during the conference writ large, we are doing a project that we're pretty excited about. We are gonna be bringing a bunch of quilt squares and constructing a quilt in the tradition of women's ways of making. We're trying to sort of capture the moment of the conference, which we think it's an important conference. I'm glad about the things that Asao Inouye is bringing to the forefront of our attention at the conference, and we want to remember that. And so anyway, we're going to be assembling this quilt, and we really would be happy to have anyone participate. So you can get a square at multiple places, but particularly at the SIG and the Feminist Workshop. So please keep an eye out for those things.
In November 2017, the Feminist Caucus authored a white paper titled Feminist Labor Practices and Ethical Working Conditions in Writing Programs, Statement of Values and Definitions. In the white paper, the caucus reports that the labor situation in composition studies continues to deteriorate at an alarming rate. The caucus writes, Quote, "At this historical moment, we find ourselves at a tipping point. We can continue to address our labor issues by using the same strategies we have used in the past and that have not been successful, or we can choose to interrupt the narrative by challenging its fundamental assumptions. We choose interruption." In the statement, the caucus identifies areas in need of intervention and conclude by, quote, "reactivating calls for a censure system that would clearly identify programs not employing ethical labor practices. In doing so, we recognize the importance and the risk of harming our most vulnerable and marginalized institutions and students, and we offer suggestions for how the organization and its constituent groups could put resources in place to support their development toward compliance."
Our white paper aims to provide some sort of interruption to what we see as this really sort of crisis moment. Yes. In labor practices and a request to do something institutionally, because we keep saying, oh, it's so unfortunate, but there's only so much we can do as WPAs. There's only so much we can do as a program. So we kind of need the organization, the larger organization, to make some of these changes actually happen.
How did labor become an important concern for the Feminist Caucus?
We had some conversations in the Feminist Caucus, and particularly in our SIG, I believe, last year at the C's, where we talked a little bit about labor, and we identified it as one of the primary issues that we're addressing. And if we are going to use a feminist lens to approach how we understand the field and practice feminist administration, then we really have to address the labor issues and not just allow them to continue to deteriorate.
In the white paper, you mentioned some of the labor problems facing writing programs. Can you say, how do you understand the labor situation in writing studies?
So the labor conditions of the field are bad. They are conditions that are not acceptable or sustainable. We continue to say we need to make things better. And every year as a WPA, I find myself in August scrambling to hire people at the last minute. There are people I can't offer any kind of good deal to. There are people I can offer maybe one semester or two semesters worth of courses. Maybe I can give them benefits, but usually not. Sometimes I can give them office space, but usually not. Definitely not a phone. Probably not a mailbox. So it's not a sustainable model, yet I've been doing it for 15 years. And every August I say, why am I doing this again? And every August I do it again. And I'm tired of it. And I think that's how I came to this project.
This isn't just us. This is stuff that's been documented well by, and probably better by, other people. But yeah, I think some of the things that we've been talking about, the pay rate, I mean, you can see in those sections, if you break it down, the amount of students that instructors are dealing with, the instability, I think that's an enormous problem, not just of the classes, but not knowing if they're going to have insurance, not knowing what classes they'll have to prepare for. Everybody who does this work worries about it all the time and deals with it, but there's a large part of our field that has nothing to do with any of this and benefits from how this is structured, and they don't even talk about it at conferences. It's not interesting to them. They're more interested in more traditional academic development and, you know, projects and individual things. So I feel like that's this continued problem. As you go to a lot of our national conferences, and there's like these, there's always strands, but there's like people that are like, oh my God, there are serious problems, and the rest are like, I'm here to present my project on this thing. And that's I think if you work as a WPA, you change dramatically because of that. Like, it's a different life.
And if I could add, and this is one of the things that was hard for us to kind of admit to ourselves, but we kind of came to this after a lot of discussion about it, is these labor conditions also force us as a field to make decisions that maybe aren't the best for students or for composition as a field. So for example, because we have to hire just to get bodies in the classroom, we'll hire people who have MAs in literature and no training in composition and rhetoric. And mm-hmm. you know, if we're making disciplinary arguments that we're really a field and we really have a body of knowledge, then our practices kind of belie that, and we do things that shoot ourselves in the foot all the time. And that was something, though, that was hard for us to admit, because, I mean, one, we're complicit in it, but two, we're kind of saying some of the people we have who are great teachers maybe aren't the most qualified to be teaching it, and yet we keep hiring them. So mm-hmm. That was hard.
In the white paper, the caucus recommends a censure system and calls for the organization to censure programs that don't employ ethical labor practices. Why does the caucus believe a censure system is necessary? And why is it important that a censure come from a national organization?
That's a tough one.
I'm sorry.
That's the thing. That's the big thing. I feel like we initially, I think I talked about how this was, I think, a really fun collaboration to be a part of, but like kind of painful too, because we kept getting to places and recognizing, no, we're not really doing anything. We're just saying what everybody knows. Mm-hmm. And we were constantly recognizing our complicity in this, which again, I think that's what a feminist lens gets us to. And that's uncomfortable, as it should be. And we were kind of living in that and marinating in that for a long time. Mm-hmm. And in so much of our research, we came up against the wonderful statements that CS has about appropriate labor conditions for faculty, because they have it. I mean, certainly our organization has really rich, wonderful resources. We have great mm-hmm. research to draw from, but there's just no teeth. And that was what we kept coming to. And there have been historical discussions of what a censure system would look like. And that was initially what was recommended when the CS program of excellence certificate came about. There was a discussion of essentially both a carrot and a stick, and just the carrot came out. And I think that's generally where we kind of live too. We like the idea of rewarding something, this positive behavior and good things that are happening, but it just hasn't worked. We can't do it on our own. We can't do it as individual WPAs. We don't really have a lot of say in what happens, but we have this big, wonderful organization, and we just really need more from that organization. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to get this argument back on the table and recognize that this is a 30-year-old, at least, recommendation. Mm-hmm. And in those 30 years, what we've done has not worked. We have gone in the wrong direction. And that is not C's fault by any means, but that's just sort of the moment we are at. We need some sort of counterbalance to say, we can't do this anymore. This is not serving students.
Yeah.
As Kate is saying, you can only bring the like C's recommendations to your administrators so many times before they like laugh at you. Like, you want how many students in your class? So we can create all these position statements, but like they are not doing anything for the majority of us. So what can the organization do? And I think they're trying to do a lot of really different things with this conference this year too, like really trying to switch things up and have different voices be heard. So there's not this perception of like, we're going to support the same people all the time and, you know, keep this echelon up here, and then all these other people who need this help aren't going to get it.
Part of the reason that we want the organization to do something at the organizational level is it's the problem of the prophet in your own land. Even mm-hmm. though we as WPAs bring those statements to our provosts and our deans, they don't listen to us because it's us saying it. And so when we have the organization to fall back on, or if we have the threat of censure to bring to our provosts and deans, saying to a provost, well, we're not meeting national guidelines. Well, if they don't really recognize composition as a field anyway, they're not going to pay attention to that. But being able to say to somebody, we've been censured by our national organization for not following best practices, hopefully that's something at least to get their attention, because that's not a word you want associated with your university in any context.
And so what would a censure look like?
Well, I think it would be something that would have to come out of the CS executive committee. Mm-hmm. And we are talking about maybe collaborating with, we're hoping other organizations would get behind it too, maybe WPA or CWPA. maybe, Taika, one of the reasons that these conversations about censor always stall is because we get caught up in the details of how it would happen, and so then we just table the discussion about doing it, and that prevents progress on it. And so we wanted to force the conversation about doing it and then work on the details. So if we, our feeling is if we can get people in agreement or some kind of consensus that this might be a good thing, once we have that, then we can move forward with the logistics of it. But we didn't want to scuttle the conversation by just saying, oh, it would be hard, or, oh, I don't know how that would work. Because it seems like that's why it failed the last time when you read the literature on it. From when they tried this before, it was like it got caught up in all the legal ramifications and, oh, well, who would do this and who would enact it and what would that look like? And it seems to us that's when the conversation died. And so we were looking for a way to put this forward without having it die before it even hit the conversation.
A link to the caucus white paper is included in the notes for today's episode. The Feminist Caucus is requesting feedback on the white paper, including comments, feedback, or suggestions for revision. The Feminist Caucus business meeting is today, Thursday, March 15th, from 4:45 p.m. to 6 p.m. in the Kansas City Convention Center, Bartle, room 2215B.
In our next segment, we return to the International Researchers Consortium. As we heard several episodes back, the consortium has been a place for international writing researchers to come together and learn from each other about the variety of geolocations and disciplines that have taken up the study of writing. Today, we talk to consortium steering committee member Violeta Molina Natera. Natera's work focuses on writing centers and writing programs in Colombia and in Latin America. She'll tell us a bit about her work and her experiences with the consortium.
My name is Violeta Molina Natera. I work with Pontificia Universidad Javeriana in Cali, Colombia. I am the founder of the first writing center in Colombia as well as in South America. I used to be the writing center director. So my work has been mostly in writing centers and now in writing programs. And I was the creator of the Latin American Writing Centers and Writing Programs Association. I am also the representative for IWCA of Latin America. I am board member representing Latin America. And this is basically who I am, I think.
And what does your current research focus on?
My interest right now is work with the Latin American countries that are developing new writing centers and new writing programs. Writing centers and writing programs is something really new. Most of them are less than 5 years. My writing center is one of the oldest with 10 years. This year is the 10th anniversary. But most of them are less than 6 or 5 years. This is a new field in Latin America, and we are trying to understand what does it mean, a writing center in our context, because it's not just copy-paste the idea of writing center, for example. Yeah. We are trying to develop this idea in our culture, in our context, with our differences. And my interest is to try to figure out what is happening, what's going on that the university says, okay, maybe writing courses are not enough, maybe writing courses are not working as well as we want, so we need to do something more. My research is about the theories that they are using to found those writing programs, the practices, what do are they doing, and the administration. What are the administration practices that they are doing? My main objective is to try to help to the person that are leading these ideas, you know, the writing program director, the writing program administrator, because we just know how to teach writing, but we don't know how to deal with a writing program. We don't know how to deal with a writing center. So this is my main objective.
And what have you learned from your work with Latin American writing programs?
I conducted a really big survey, more than 100 questions. This was my main research tool. I conducted this survey and I asked for those topics. And also I did three different case studies in three different countries, one in Argentina, one in Puerto Rico, and one here in Colombia. What I found so far is regarding theories, we don't have, as you have in the US, composition and rhetoric and composition. But people here in Latin America are more in the field of linguistics, especially in really the South, Chile, Argentina. They are really, really good in systemic functional linguistics. Mm-hmm. Like Holliday's theories and all of that. And they base their practices in theories. But the interesting thing that I want to highlight is they are contributing to this theory. You know, these theories are really strong in Australia, but mm-hmm. they are not just taking the theories. They are growing the theory. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, one of the most significant aspects regarding theories we are using. But the issues are all the scholarships is in English, and not everybody can read in English. We don't have access to all the scholarships, all the books, especially if you don't pay by Amazon. It's interesting because in the writing center world, we can find people that are really good with handling these theories, but we can find also people that are not involved in writing center studies as well. You know, we are really good in linguistics. This is our main studies, and this is the main base of writing teaching.
How did you first become involved with the International Researchers Consortium?
I went 2 years ago. It was in Houston, I think, and I participate in this beautiful workshop that is coordinated by Tian. And this is a really great experience to be part of this workshop. The whole day workshop is amazing. And in that workshop, they talked about the International Research Consortium. And I have it marked in the program that I really want to go that, but I was invited to participate in that meeting. So I went and I was involved.
And how has your experience been with the International Researchers Consortium?
I think this is the International Research Consortium is a great opportunity to really be involved in what's happening in the research world around the world. Because I think most of the most interesting research is happening in the US, but around the globe, different things are happening. This is a beautiful opportunity to really meet people that are doing different research, that are doing research with different approaches, with different theoretical backgrounds. It's a great opportunity to really have a real image that what is happening around the world. Mm-hmm. with the writing research, you can really reach the people that are working in different ways, in different approaches with research in writing.
Are there any events or panels you want to highlight at the convention this year?
Unfortunately, I can't go to the first seat this year. I'm really sad because I am finishing my dissertation. But we have our next Latin American conference regarding writing centers and writing programs next year in 2019 in Guadalajara, Mexico. So it would be great if people of the world can join us in Mexico to talk about what are they doing in their writing programs.
For today's final segment, we turn to the non-Western/global rhetoric special interest group. To talk about that group, we'll hear a discussion I had with Dr. Therese Samra-Graben, who is one of the co-leaders of the group. The SIG has their business meeting this evening at 6:30 p.m. in the Kansas City Marriott downtown, room Lester Young B.
My name is Therese Samra-Graben. I'm an associate professor of English at Florida State University. And then from 2015 to 2018, I've also been fortunate enough to be a visiting research fellow in the Department of English at the University of South Africa, but it's a non-residential appointment.
Today we're talking to Dr. Graben about her work and her experience with the non-Western/global rhetoric special interest group.
I'm a co-leader of the SIG. There are four of us who tend to lead it each year. Keith Lloyd, Nicole Horry, and Adnan Salhi. And these other three people have become very valuable colleagues to me. I couldn't imagine the work without them. It's been a very active support group, a very active group of colleagues that mentor horizontally. We have an active Google Groups. The Google Groups list functions for us to be able to check in with each other, to share syllabi, to share course links. We are conducting a bibliography project together. We have set up a space where we're sharing teaching resources. We've been developing courses for graduate students as well as undergraduate students. And of course, these courses take on different iterations depending on our campuses, our institutions, and our programs. So we continue to share resources and have dialogues about the differences, the distinctions. Maybe the conversations have been the best because this group is constituted of people who do what they might call traditional comparative rhetoric, which is where they study two traditions. Some see themselves as transnational scholars. Some see themselves as working with subgenres. Some see themselves as primarily interested in making US-centric curriculum more cross-cultural. So it's been a very nice space.
How do you see the work of the non-Western/global rhetoric special interest group?
We are exploring together what it means to teach and research on cross-cultural topics and or in cross-cultural and transnational contexts. Sometimes the work is centered in composition, sometimes it's centered in rhetoric. We tend not to make such stark divisions, but I can say there are quite a few comparative rhetorical scholars who move in and out of the conference. We've held on to the non-Western tag long enough to eventually qualify for standing group status. We are very interested in applying for standing group status, and in order to do that, a group has to be on the program 5 years consecutively. The group was on the program for 4 years consecutively, and then it was not on the program for several years. Once we put the group back on the program, we realized we needed to actually be on the program 5 years under the same name to be able to apply for standing group status. We're aware that the name itself is generative. It creates a dilemma because, in fact, much of the work we do is trying to elide Western and non-Western binaries. Mm-hmm. Yet that, in fact, for better or for worse, is the term under which, you know, the group has formed. The past few years, the affordance has probably been less toward institutional status and more that it's been a nice way to begin the discussion each year, mm-hmm. is to really think about what is our affinity to this term, and is there still value in locating some things in the West versus the non-West? And if so, what is that value? And if not, how can we move beyond it?
Mm-hmm. What about your involvement in the SIG has been most rewarding?
The influence it has had on my scholarship and teaching. It was through that group that Hui Wu, another colleague, and I decided the time was right to try to co-edit a collection called Alternative Sources of Rhetorical Traditions, which is a huge project. We're in the midst of it right now. And this is an edited collection of original work. It's annotated translations of treatises or texts or partial treatises that sort of reflect alternative sources of rhetorical traditions. So maybe Arabic traditions, Byzantine, Chinese, Hawaiian and Polynesian, Indian and Nepalese. It's not trying to be comprehensive because we understand it's impossible to have a single volume or a single project that accounts for everything.
You mentioned the time is right for the collection that you're working on. Can you say a bit more about why the time is right for a collection like this?
Yes, and I will try to channel Hui, as you know, I do this as well, to honor her and honor all of her work in Chinese rhetorics. I think what we realized was there was a need for a critical vocabulary that emerged out of various rhetorical regions and rhetorical traditions that would enable scholars who may not be familiar with those traditions to then study them and have a way in. So in other words, it was a need to begin to discover more emergent glosses rather than taking one Greco-Roman gloss that we love and appreciate and then trying to apply it to these other traditions that we want to understand and illuminate. We also realized there were probably more varied methodologies for doing investigative work into these traditions and even teaching them, and that those methodologies were best discovered by tapping into the experience of folks who were doing translation. We're starting to see a wonderful influx of edited collections on global traditions, and it's so long overdue. And so we were thinking a little bit about a book that could be seen as an auxiliary piece of work to this.
What do you hope will be the impact of the book?
I know I can't speak fully on behalf of Hui, and I think we hope it will be seen as a resource that opens people's eyes to the other resources that we feel have influenced it. Or we would love for it to be used as a teaching tool. We're not necessarily creating it as a textbook or even as a full anthology. It's more a demonstration of methodologies. I think we have in mind an audience that could be equally graduate students and faculty colleagues. We would love for people to pick it up and say, gosh, wouldn't this have been wonderful to have as part of my cachet of resources, you know, when I was undergoing my graduate training or even defining my first project. I think we also hope perhaps that the critical gloss will get taken up and that we could, you know, have more working vocabularies.
How can folks learn more about the work of the non-Western / global rhetoric SIG?
On Thursday evening from 6:30 to 7:45, there will be a meeting of the non-Western global rhetoric special interest group. And we would love for people to attend if they are attending the conference. Several of us are also putting on a panel on Friday morning, 9:30 to 10:45, and the panel is titled Laboring Toward Global Rhetorical Practices in U.S.-Based Classrooms, Implications for Teachers of Composition and Rhetoric. When we meet as a SIG, we tend to often talk a lot about our scholarship, but many of us in the SIG, we appear on panels over and over again at field conferences really thinking about pedagogy. So we tend not to do one without the other. We would love it if people would show up at both events.
Did you make it to your morning yoga session today? I hope so. You can join again tomorrow in the Kansas City Marriott downtown and again on Saturday. The 45-minute yoga session will begin at 6:45 a.m. and will be led by Sarah Mosley. Mats will also be available on site. And if you listened to our first episode, you heard about the remote accessibility pilot and the Scholars for the Dream Lounge. Be sure to drop in to a remote session and to the lounge before the end of the convention. The lounge will be closed tonight, of course, for the Scholars for the Dream reception and the ANSL Duo Awards ceremonies. The reception will begin tonight and run from 6 to 7 in the Barney Alice Lobby, and the ANSL Duo Awards will be in the Colonial Ballroom at 7 p.m. Thank you for listening today to the 2018 Four Seas Podcast. Tomorrow I'll be back featuring conversations with Shane Wood, who helped design the Escape and Reflection Room at the convention.
We'll also hear from Lana Oidat and Tamara Isak, leaders of the Arab Muslim SIG, as well as Cruz Medina, one of the co-leaders of the Latinx Caucus. Finally, we'll hear from one other member of the International Researchers Consortium Steering Committee, Dr. Lance Cummings. In the notes for today's episode, you'll find links to the Feminist Caucus white paper, where you can read and leave feedback.
Finally, I'm asking for your feedback for the podcast. And so to do that, I'd like you to call me. What's one thing you've learned today at the convention? You can share by calling and leaving a voicemail at 508-348-9128. That's 508-348-9128. Just tell me, what's one thing that you've learned today at the convention? Your contributions may be included in an episode of the podcast. Thanks again, and I hope you're all having a beautiful day.